As the Protestant Reformation spread throughout Europe, persecution and death often followed. But the Scottish reformer John Knox refused to stand idly by.
He looked to Scotland and he saw young Mary, Queen of Scots, on the throne. Then he looked to England and he saw Bloody Mary, who was persecuting the church. He looked to France and he saw the Queen Mother, Catherine de' Medici. Knox was furious.
Well, we as 21st century American Christians have a difficult time imagining such persecution. It's sobering to realize that even with the threat of death over their heads, the reformers stood firm. You're listening to Renewing Your Mind, and on this Saturday, we return to Dr. W. Robert Godfrey's A Survey of Church History. He's been concentrating on the Protestant Reformation. By the mid-1500s, the Reformation had spread throughout Europe. Today, Dr. Godfrey will tell us the inspiring story of John Knox. It's a lesson titled, The Scottish Reformation.
Well, we have been looking together at what we might call the emerging theology of the 16th century. We've looked at Martin Luther, we've looked at John Calvin, we've looked a tiny little bit at the Anabaptists, we've looked some at the Roman Catholics, and these were the great competing theological ideas that occurred in the 16th century. And in that process, we've looked a little bit at the historical setting in which they emerged and to which they spoke. And now I'd like to talk a little bit more about the spread of these ideas. Because the Reformation was not just ideas and doctrines, as important as they were. The Reformation was every bit as much a reform in the life of the church. And that meant that preachers would carry the message of the Reformation into all of the countries of Europe. In some countries, they ended up not being very successful. For a time, there was success in Italy, in the city of Lucca, for example, by Reformed teachers, but there was great oppression there. The same happened in Spain, where there was a great deal of persecution that really shut down the Reformation at a very early point. In other parts of Europe, there was great success very early on without a great deal of struggle or controversy because of early support by monarchs, such as in Scandinavia, where Lutheranism spread. We can't, unfortunately, look at all of those countries, but I'd like to look at a couple of representative ones that are particularly important to our understanding of the history of the church as it continues beyond the 16th century. So I want to begin in Scotland. Now, it would be much better if Sinclair Ferguson were here to do it with a Scottish accent because it makes everything sound so much more spiritual and so much more profound with a Scottish accent. Occasionally, I try a Scottish accent, but it always seems to slip into Irish. So I will spare you that. Scotland, of course, was in the 16th century a separate kingdom from England, and indeed, most of the Scots didn't like the English very much. That may not have changed. We'll have to ask Dr. Ferguson about that. But Scotland historically had been more allied with France than with England because France could be for Scotland a kind of counterweight to English influence. And Scotland had gone through a difficult period. Scotland was, in the 16th century, really kind of a third world country. It was not very wealthy. It had a kind of wild and woolly reputation, both for its nobility and for its common people. And they had gone through some real struggles as well in terms of the monarchy. King James V had died in battle in 1542, leaving just one young child behind, his daughter Mary, known to history as Mary, Queen of Scots. Not to be confused with Bloody Mary in England. Mary, Queen of Scots, was 1 week old when her father died and she became queen. Her mother was part of the French aristocracy, and so that connection between Scotland and France was carried on because her mother became the regent in Scotland, in charge until her daughter would come of age. And Mary was actually sent to France to be raised in the French royal court for most of her life. She would actually briefly be married to first the crown prince and then the king of France, who died rather young, and Mary, as a young widow, would then later come back to Scotland, but that's getting a little ahead of our tale. The Reformation was carried to Scotland probably in the first place in the form of books. John Knox said it was merchants and mariners who first brought the Reformation to Scotland. And then it began to come through preachers. And those preachers began rather courageously to proclaim the gospel in the face of determined government opposition. Many of those early leaders were martyred, and it was in that context then that John Knox, the most famous of the leaders of the Scottish Reformation, came to faith. He had worked closely with George Wishart, one of the early preachers who was martyred in 1546, and led to a real uprising in Scotland against the murderers, as they thought it was, of George Wishart. And because things were wild and woolly in Scotland, those early Protestants attacked the cardinal, who was also one of the leading government officials in Scotland, Cardinal Beaton, and murdered him and took his castle. And John Knox was called as his first pastoral charge to be the chaplain to these soldiers that had murdered Beaton and held the castle. So this is a kind of wild beginning. And in that early charge, he preached from the book of Daniel, and he struck two themes that were basic to all of his preaching and all of his ministry. First was that we are justified by faith alone, and the second was that we must flee idolatry. Those were the passions of Knox's heart, that we really understand the gospel and the peace that it brought us in God, and that we avoid the idolatry, as he saw it, of the Roman Catholic Church. That first call, like Calvin's first call, didn't last all that long, about 19 months, and then the castle was taken by royal troops. Actually, it didn't last that long. He was sentenced for 19 months to be a galley slave on a French vessel. Galley slaves rowed the ship when the wind was calm, and the life expectancy of galley slaves was not very long. There was a great story that the French officers on this ship decided they ought to do some evangelistic work with the slaves who were Protestants on this ship. And so they brought a picture of the Virgin Mary to the slaves and ordered them all to kiss the picture. And they presented this picture to John Knox, and there was a kind of hush because, after all, he was sort of the minister, he was the leader of the movement. Would he compromise? And Knox took the picture in his hands, and he looked at the picture and said, Our Lady is light enough, let her learn to swim, and threw the picture overboard. So this was sort of typical of Knox in the way that he conducted himself. Knox always saw himself as primarily a preacher. He did some writing, but he was primarily a preacher. He said, I consider myself rather called of my God to instruct the ignorant, comfort the sorrowful, confirm the weak, and rebuke the proud by the tongue and lively voice in these corrupt days, rather than compose books for ages to come. And he was a thunderer, and he was an amazing and powerful preacher. When he was released from being a galley slave, he preached for a time in England near the Scottish border to try to encourage further infiltration of Scotland. And then when King Edward died and Bloody Mary came to the throne, he fled from England, where it was also no longer safe for him. He ministered for a time in Frankfurt in Germany, and then ended up in Geneva for a time. And it was Knox who said when he got to Geneva under Calvin, since the days of the apostles, there has never been a purer Christian community than what I find in Geneva. Calvin probably wouldn't have agreed with that and thought it was a little optimistic, but Knox learned a great deal while he was in Geneva, was very impressed by Calvin as the reformer. Nonetheless, his heart continued to burn for Scotland. His desire was that he might be able to return to Scotland. And in 1558, he was rather depressed as he looked at the condition of Europe. He looked to Scotland and he saw young Mary, Queen of Scots, on the throne, guided by her mother. Then he looked to England and he saw Bloody Mary, who was persecuting the church. He looked to France and he saw the Queen Mother, Catherine de' Medici, running things and persecuting Protestants. And it led him to write his most famous work, probably, The First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women. What do all these things have in common? What do all these persecutions have in common? They're led by women. And this was unnatural. The timing was really bad because this book had no more than come off the press than Bloody Mary died and Elizabeth came to the throne in England. Elizabeth never quite forgave Knox for his blast on the trumpet against the monstrous regiment of women. And when Knox wanted to travel back to Scotland in 1559, Elizabeth would not give him permission to travel through England. Still, he did arrive back in Scotland in 1559, and in an amazing way, the country seemed ready for the preaching of the gospel. And there was great response to the preaching of the gospel, not only amongst many common people, but also amongst the lairds, that is, the minor nobility. The minor nobility were increasingly tired of French influence and French authority, and so increasingly they turned to Knox and to the new faith that was being preached. And very quickly, the lairds and the Parliament of Scotland outlawed Roman Catholicism, outlawed the Mass, and approved of Protestantism as the official religion of the realm. This posed a huge problem because now all of a sudden, a huge number of preachers were needed for the whole kingdom, and there was a shortage. And so Knox began to urge lairds to look around for talented young men and send them to be educated for ministers. This was what we might call an external call. It didn't matter what the young man thought in his heart. He better go be a minister because we need ministers. And this was a great step forward, and Knox really did preach that gospel of grace. He had a great sensitivity about it. He was ferocious when he was opposed, but he was a very tender pastor in many ways. He wrote once, "I know how hard the battle is. I know the anger, wrath, and indignation which the human soul conceiveth against God, calling all his promises in doubt, and being ready every hour utterly to fall from God, against which rests only faith. Wherein, if we continue, our most desperate calamities shall turn to gladness and to a prosperous end." So he could be a very tender and sympathetic preacher. He knew about his own sin. He wrote, "Although I never lack the presence and plain image of my own wretched infirmity, yet seeing sin so manifestly abound in all estates, I am compelled to thunder out the threatenings of God against obstinate rebels. In doing that, I sometimes am wounded, knowing myself criminal and guilty in many, yea, in all things that in others I reprehend." So he was someone who knew sin in himself and knew that he had to thunder out the holiness of God, and yet at the same time wanted to be sure that he was being sensitive and bringing comfort and assurance to people. So 1559, 1560, great spread and success of the Reformation cause, in part by government approval. And then in 1561, the young Queen Mary, who would have been, just 19 at the time, comes back to Scotland. She arrived on a cloudy day. Sinclair Ferguson said to me, "That's the only kind of days we have in Scotland." Arrived on a cloudy, rainy day, and John Knox observed, "She brings with her only darkness, dolor, and impiety." So they were set up for controversy. She was a young widow. She was the widowed Queen of France, the Dowager Queen of France already, at 19. And she came back with a determination to see that Roman Catholicism would be restored. She knew she couldn't do everything in a day, but she thought, "There will be a way that I can restore Roman Catholicism to this realm." And the first thing she did was to insist that she be able to have Mass in her private chapel. Now, that seems reasonable, doesn't it? The Queen should be able to have Mass in her private chapel, but the Mass was outlawed in Scotland. You see, Knox had convinced many who followed him that the Mass was essentially idolatrous. That to bow down and worship the consecrated bread at the Mass was an act of idolatry. To believe that Christ was sacrificed by a priest on the altar was an act of idolatry. And therefore, if idolatry is to be banished from the realm, the Mass cannot be celebrated anywhere in the realm. And so Knox thundered about this. Mary, who was used to being charming and being successful as a charmer, invited Knox. And she said, "You know, I understand that you're a minister, and I understand that you believe you have to express God's will. And I just want you to know that any time you think I've done anything wrong, you are welcome to come and talk to me, and I would be glad to hear you." And John Knox said, "Madam, I have been called to a public ministry, not to creep in princes' palaces and whisper in their ears." This was one of many unpleasant meetings the two of them had. He was not charmed by her, and he understood that she was out to do the cause harm. She was clever, and having gotten the Lairds to concede that she could have Mass in her private chapel, then she began to travel. And wherever she traveled, she opened a chapel. And whenever she left a priest behind to continue to offer Mass in the chapel. Knox was furious. But Knox was beginning to see his influence somewhat diminish because the Queen was being effective. She was young, she was charming, she was single. What that meant is there were any number of noblemen who hoped that they might be able to marry the Queen and become, if not king, at least prince consort of the Queen. And so she was beginning rather effectively to neutralize the aristocracy's support of Knox. Knox thundered about this. Reformation continued to spread through preachers, but his influence was being diminished. Then Mary made a serious strategic mistake. Queen Elizabeth was concerned about Mary, Queen of Scots, because Mary, Queen of Scots, had a claim on the English throne. And Roman Catholics in England believed that Elizabeth was an illegitimate child of her father and therefore not entitled to sit on the throne. And that Mary was in the line of succession. And so Roman Catholic support began to focus on Mary. And Elizabeth was very unhappy about this. And she tried to think, how do I neutralize this? And Elizabeth, who was really shrewd and clever, thought, "I'm going to send up to her court a thoroughly worthless young man who has royal blood. And Mary is going to be tempted into marrying him to increase her claim on the throne. And then his worthlessness will be revealed, and her position will be weakened." And it worked like a charm. Mary got completely suckered by this activity. Richard Darnley appeared in Scotland. Mary was charmed by him. He was young, he was handsome, he was dissolute. And they got married, and Mary really thought she was increasing her claim on the throne. Things became so corrupt at court that the Lairds became increasingly upset. Darnley seemed to be, how shall we put this so that the children can listen to this lecture? Darnley seemed to be sleeping with most anybody around, male or female, and it became a scandal in the court. And Darnley was eventually imprisoned, and then Mary was imprisoned. She was toppled from the throne and forced to abdicate in the name of her young son, only a few weeks old, history really repeating itself, her son who would become James VI of Scotland. That James VI would later become, on the death of Elizabeth, James I of England. And so this James would be a very important figure in history. And Knox and others were determined that he would be properly raised. And he was carefully raised by Presbyterian tutors. He became a pretty good theologian. He also learned to hate Presbyterianism. He thought bishops were much more respectful to monarchs than presbyters were. Presbyters seemed to think that they could speak as equals to monarchs. James never warmed up to that idea. He liked bishops who were subservient. He would later say, in one of his few quotable statements, "No bishop, no king." If there's no hierarchy in the church, how can there be a hierarchy in the state? If the divine institution doesn't need a hierarchy, how can we argue that the civil institution needs a hierarchy? And I think he was right. I think the resistance to bishops ultimately amongst Presbyterians and Congregationalists prepared America for democracy. If we can elect clergymen, if clergymen in gatherings of presbyteries can make important decisions for the church, why can't people make important decisions for the state? That's getting a little ahead of the story. In any case, things sort of went from bad to worse. Darnley died very mysteriously and tragically, and Mary may have had something to do with it. The house in which he was staying under house arrest inexplicably found itself with a basement full of dynamite. Or maybe gunpowder. I don't know if they had dynamite then. But anyway, of gunpowder, and it blew up. And poor Darnley was killed by strangulation. So it's very mysterious. But all of this corruption at court is what then led finally to the toppling of Mary and to her replacement. She eventually escaped arrest and fled south to the protection of her dear cousin Elizabeth, who didn't know what to do with her, and so put her in jail for about 20 years and finally cut off her head. Elizabeth didn't like the idea of executing monarchs. She thought someone might extend that principle to her. But Mary became too dangerous. Mary was caught in correspondence with the King of Spain plotting the Spanish Armada and the invasion of England. And Elizabeth couldn't have that. And Scotland was then left with a young king, really an infant king, and the Reformation was able to establish itself, was able to settle in, although the lairds remained concerned about Knox's independence. One of the regents in Scotland who stood at Knox's grave in 1572 looked into the grave and said, "Here lies one who never feared or flattered any flesh." And that was true of Knox. He was a brave man. One of his last ministerial acts was to mount the pulpit of the High Kirk in Edinburgh in 1572 after news had come of the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in France. That was a wave of persecution that broke out in France that killed somewhere around 50,000 Protestants in a week in France. And this word reached Scotland and was received with horror by Knox. And he rose very frail in the pulpit in the High Kirk. And as he looked out at the congregation, there sat the French ambassador, come to be entertained by watching this old preacher preach. And Knox saw him in the crowd and said, "Go home and tell your master he's a murderer." And that expressed that courage, that commitment. And the great legacy of the Scottish Reformation is a legacy of courage, of devotion, of faithfulness under fire for the freedom of the church to preach the gospel. And that's a good place to stop with John Knox, who never feared or flattered any flesh.
A man of conviction and courage, willing to stand in the face of persecution. John Knox is an example for us today, isn't he? We've continued Dr. Robert Godfrey's series on church history here on Renewing Your Mind. And, you know, as we listen to this study, I wonder how Knox would be received today. I think bold proclamations of truth are met with opposition in every age. Dr. Godfrey's series helps us evaluate these things with the proper historical perspective. On this 12-DVD set, you'll learn about church history stretching from the Book of Acts through modern times, 73 lessons in all, and we'll send you all 12 DVDs for your gift of any amount. You can find us at renewingyourmind.org or call us at 800-435-4255. 43:43. Knox was a man of strength. He didn't back down when he faced difficult circumstances. To our modern ears, his straight talk, even his harsh talk, can seem a little strong. But that's why we study history. We need to understand that there are issues worth standing for. So again, request this 12-DVD set with your gift of any amount. Our phone number again is 800-435-4343, and our web address is renewingyourmind.org. By the way, you can listen to Renewing Your Mind on several platforms, on your local station, on our podcast, and also on RefNet, our 24-hour internet radio station. You can tune in anytime, day or night, and you can also hear faithful teachers and preachers proclaiming the Word of God. You can listen anytime on refnet.fm, or you can download the free RefNet app. Well, next Saturday, Dr. Godfrey continues this series on church history, and he'll explain the Dutch Revolt and the rise of the Dutch Reformed Church. We hope you'll join us next Saturday for Renewing Your Mind.